The showman applauded. "Young friend, I bow to your talent. If your parents don't have another trade in mind, you'll be the best storyteller in Weyern one day. I would bet my daily theatre takings on that."
"You're an actor?"
The boy couldn't believe his luck. "Oh, yes. I'm the incredible Rodario, the emperor of actors and showmen in all of Gerdlegard," he boasted in his normal patter. "I have the good fortune to lead my own company, the Curiosum, the best in the world. If it were nearer, I would invite you to see it, young man." He ruffled the boy's short brown hair. Omadin stood tall. Praise from the mouth of such a master meant a great deal to him. The door opened and, silhouetted against the light, Rodario saw the figure of a long-haired woman carrying a basket.
"Who are you?"
she asked, in obvious agitation.
"Get away from the children!"
Rodario took her point.
"Don't be afraid, good woman.
It's the incredible Rodario. He's an actor, and he's washed up," said Omadin at once, jumping up and embracing his mother, full of delight. "I told him the Nightmare Island story, and he said I've got talent."
"Has he been giving you big ideas?"
She came in, shutting the door behind her. Rodario saw a woman, slightly older than himself, in simple linen clothing. Fishermen, it seemed, weren't doing too well in Weyern.
"My greetings," he said, then remembered he was not wearing a shirt. "Forgive my appearance, but my clothes were wet."
She soon calmed down, realizing he presented no danger to the children, herself, or what they owned. A nearly naked body couldn't conceal anything, neither a weapon nor stolen goods.
"I am Talina."
She placed her basket on the table.
"I'm sorry I was unfriendly."
He waved away her apology.
"But of course, I quite understand."
"He gave me money,"
said Fleera, handing the purse to her mother.
"That was for the fuel for the fire," Rodario smiled at her. "Can you tell me how I get off this island? I have to go to Mephidania."
"If you go over the dunes and follow the path to the right, you'll get to Stillwater, a little fishing village. You'll find someone there to take you." Talina took the herbs out of her basket and rinsed them in a bowl of water.
"Did you really enjoy my son's story?"
"Very much," Rodario confirmed, giving Ormadin a wink. "And I was quite serious about his talent. I know a few storytellers who might be glad to have a gifted pupil like him."
"Oh, please, Mother. Fleera will do the fishing when she grows up," begged the boy.
"No, I shan't," came the answer, quick as a flash. Talina turned round.
"Quiet, you two. See what your father says."
She looked at Rodario.
"You'd better get on your way now. Mendar will be taking his sloop over to Mephidania around midday. He takes Siliti oysters over to the market. Tell Mendar I sent you, and he won't charge."
"Talina, thank you." He pulled his shirt down from the rack and put it on.
"Perhaps we'll meet again," he said to Ormadin,
crouching down in front of the young boy.
"Have you got something to write with? I'll give you the names of some famous storytellers."
The boy nodded and went off to find a piece of slate and some chalk. Rodario wrote the names of two celebrated narrators and the kingdoms they lived in. "But you'll have to ask around, because they're usually touring. You'll find them all right." He ruffled the boy's hair again. "Palandiel will help you, Ormadin." Talina gave him some bread and dried fish.
"For the journey," she said.
In her eyes he could read that her son would never have the opportunity to leave the island. It was his lot in life to become a fisherman like his father, and his father and grandfather before him.
"Elria, be with you."
She went with him to the door and pointed to the fog-bound dunes. He had only gone 3 paces before he heard the door close again. The white veils of mist that enveloped him tasted sweetly of salt and sand. Rodario strode up the sand dunes and found the path Talina had described.
On the way, he ate some of the food she had given him. The fish had a fine aroma of smoke and salty herbs. As the mist lifted, Rodario saw a flat, bare island with scarcely any trees, but plenty of small shrubs and grassland where sheep were grazing. The summer sun began to dry even his shoes. He was taken with that saga of the island. What if it were true? Had that been how his barge had capsized? Or had the vessel run aground and then been dragged down, her back broken from the rocks? At least, thanks to Ormadin, he had a possible explanation for the loss of the barge, even if the idea was worrying. A colony of Alpha that could not be pursued. It could become a breeding ground for terrible dangers for Girdlegard. Rodario found the village easily, and the fisherman was soon located. He was told to squat in the bow, with the extra sails, where a sailor sat mending holes in the canvas. The craft set sail, cutting swiftly through the water toward the port. Rodario dozed a little, then sat watching the sailors at work. His thoughts were wandering, and instead of the men on the deck, he saw Ormadin in his mind's eye. How sad that this talented child would not enjoy a better life.
"What are you staring at me for?"
The unfriendly question dragged Rodario out of his reverie.
Forgive me, I was lost in thought.
He smiled. Maybe this man could tell him more about the mysterious island.
I was wondering if you had any ideas as to what caused the giant wave. Last night,
The sailor put down his needle and stared at him.
Are you mad?
He spat over the side of the boat and called Elria's name quickly three times.
You'll call up Nightmare Island and kill us all!
Rodario was astonished to find a grown man so enthralled to a myth.
So it's true? As true as the sun's overhead!
The sailor spoke quietly in reply, his eyes on the waters that shone mirror-like in the light.
Keep quiet about it, right?
Rodario did not think for a moment of keeping quiet. An idea occurred.
I've got to know whether anyone has ever stepped onto the island and survived.
The sailor grabbed him by the collar and shook him hard.
If you don't strap at once!
The lake began to seethe around them. Bubbles rose to the surface, and a bestial stink reached their noses, making Rodario cough and retch. A bell clanged on deck. The crew scuttled to and fro to hoist full rig. They had to get out of the danger zone as fast as possible.
You damned idiot!
Screamed the sailor, hitting Rodario on the chin.
It's your fault!
He clambered up, dragging the actor to his feet.
He did it!
He yelled, drawing back his arm to hit out again.
He talked it up!
What do you mean? Demanded Rodario, ducking the next blow and tripping over a folded sail. He stumbled against the railing and lost his balance. Instead of helping him, the sailor gave him a shove backwards overboard.
Take him, Elria! Take him, you Alpha!
He shouted after him.
Spare us! Only spare us!
Rodario was submerged anew in Weyand's predominating element. The water was as cold as ever. He swallowed mouthfuls that this time tasted unpalatably bitter and smelt strongly of sulphur. Bubbles of varying shapes and sizes floated up past him. Some were filled with greenish gas, some were bluish or yellow. Refracted sunlight piercing the water gave them a strange beauty and diverted attention from the peril they implied. He bobbed round the gas bubbles and struggled back up to the surface. Spluttering, he gasped for air, but the fumes made him choke. Bursting bubbles made the lake look as if it were boiling. Though, luckily for him, this was not the case. The boat slipped past him. He had no chance of catching up.
You can't do that! He called out in horror. I'm really not a good swimmer! Help me back on board!
At that moment, a rocky formation broke through the frothing surface and continued to rise inexorably, sharp rock following rock, as the waters heaved and sloshed. The higher the rocks grew, the broader they became, until they had formed a massive, unscalable cliff. Water poured back, off in great torrents. The lapping of small waves had turned into the heaving mass of great rollers that rose and fell in a terrifying fashion. The sloop provided a welcome victim. She spun round and round as her planks creaked and loosened, some falling on deck and some in the lake. She lost her mast, then listed badly to one side. The mountain continued to rise from the depths, exuding hissing clouds of air and gas through cracks and crannies in the rock. Rodario grabbed one of the wooden beams that had crashed down into the water from the stricken vessel. Then, holding fast with all his might, he gave his attention once more to the horrifying spectacle before him. The sloop collided with the cliff face, shattering as the sharp rocks sliced through her wooden hull, splintering the planks. Her sails and rigging caught fast and were heaved upwards as the island rose. The boat broke up, and her crew fell or jumped overboard. The mountain was still surging up out of the water. Rodario reckoned its peak was about 200 paces high, and still it was rising. With a final horrific gurgle, the process finished. Lake water cascaded off the rock, streaming and splattering down, with the sunlight setting magnificent rainbows in the spray. The sight was unforgettable. "Ormadin was not making it up," he whispered in awe, staring at the impossible cliffs towering in front of him. "Nightmare Island really does exist." The island by now must have been about 100 paces wide and 400 high. It consisted of dark blue, nearly black stone glittering with minerals. It seemed to resemble a piece of the night sky that had broken off and fallen to earth. A petrified sheet of cooled lava had formed a flat beach on the side of the island nearest to him. Tall, thin figures emerged from the caves to launch boats. The Alpha were about to bring in their harvest. Rodario concealed himself under a floating scrap of canvas. The current was bringing him closer inland than he wanted to be. It was not his intention to explore the island, but Samosin seemed to like the idea of feeding him to the Alpha. Peering out from under the canvas, he observed how the Alpha went about picking up the dead and any survivors clinging to the pieces of the wrecked vessel. The injured they left. They only wanted the dead, or the whole. It reminded Rodario of a seal hunt he had once watched. As soon as one of the sailors surfaced to grab some air, and they sensed he was injured, the iron point of a spear, or whir, of an arrow, brought instant death. The Alpha took their time, and went about their task assiduously. They rowed past Rodario's hiding place, piercing it several times with their spears without touching him. The random piece of canvas was then ignored as it drifted nearer the shore. A gong sounded, and the boats returned to the shore. The Alpha pulled them up to the caves, and the island emitted more clouds of stinking gas. Then the shoreline dipped under the surface, and the island started to dive. "Ye gods protect me!" prayed Rodario fervently, before emerging from his hiding place, struggling out of the water and running for the dark entrance into which the Alpha had just disappeared. Girdlegard, Kingdom of Eidoslain, one-time Orc Realm of Toboribor, early summer, 6241st solar cycle. The spear leader, Hakulana, observed the sparsely vegetated hillside in the midst of Eidoslain's green landscape. It marked one of the many entrances to Toboribor's underground caves. She recognized the ruins of the old orc fortifications standing like ancient gravestones uneven against the sky. "It looks quiet," she said to her companion, Torrent, an aspiring young equerry who rode at her side. She liked his calm nature and the care he took over any task assigned to him. "Did you find any tracks?" No, Spear Leader, nothing. Akulana watched the sky, where a summer storm was brewing. Dark clouds were gathering in front of the blue. Her lance pennant fluttered in the growing breeze. Together with the 20 mounted scouts she led, they were now half a mile from the area to be traversed to reach the realm of the Orc Prince, once known as Ushnots. Akulana was too young to be able to remember the monster, but some of the veterans in Prince Malin's army told tales of the creature and its voracious cruelty. It had attempted to move north, to found a new kingdom after the lost battle of the Black Saddle. It was thanks to the dwarves that this terrible plan had been thwarted. Torrent glanced up at the movement of the clouds.
"Should we put up the tents, Spear Leader?"
Akulana shook her head. "No." She pointed to the hill with the tip of her lance. "We'll camp over there, at the cave entrance. That will save us the trouble."
"As you command, Spear Leader."
Torrent called out the order, and the troop of riders made off at a smart pace. Akulana followed them at a slight distance, never taking her eyes off the hill whose defences had been demolished by Prince Malin's soldiers shortly after the Battle of the Black Saddle. There was no sign now of the orcs' reign, or the ugly constructions of rough-hewn stone blocks that they'd forced their human serfs to build for them. She was here with her scouts to make sure that it stayed that way. The slightest hint of any orc activity in the area, they would report immediately, and the army would march in. She had a feeling that there was something hiding in that hill. As the first raindrops started to fall, they rode through the broken walls, past the ruined gates, and into the darkness of the cave. Her people, including the women, lit torches and set up camp. Each had a specific task to carry out, be it carrying for the horses, preparing a meal, or keeping guard.
"Spear Leader,"
Torrent's voice echoed through the cave.
"I found orc bones at the back there."
He handed her an orc thigh bone.
"It's not been there more than one cycle."
"You're sure about that?" Akulana got out of the saddle and looked over at the cave mouth. The clouds were racing past low over the landscape, bellies against the hillsides. Vast amounts of water cascaded down in front of the entrance in great streams, splattering onto the ground and carrying off the loose earth.
"Absolutely sure. There are lots of them."
A first lightning bolt hit the hill opposite. Almost immediately the rolling peal of thunder sounded. The horses whinnied in fear. Akulana heard their panicky steps as they pawed the ground.
"So, we've got proof. I'd rather we hadn't."
She turned to her troop.
"It's a good thing we didn't put the tents up," she said to Torrent. "Go and help the others calm the horses down, or they'll break away and trample everything. I'll go and inspect the place straight away."
But then, in the dazzle of a second lightning bolt, she saw the monster approaching the camp. Fleeting though the glimpse was, Akulana was able to take in every terrible detail of its appearance. It was huge, at least 3.5 paces high, and extremely broad. On its head, a solid Tionium helmet, in the shape of a skull, bore polished silver insignia, arranged to increase the intimidating impression. The helmet had an opening for the mouth. The creature's lips had been removed so its fangs and incisors were visible in a permanent grin. The helmet itself had long spikes, bolting metal and skull together. Akulana drew back, and in her fear, did not even realize she had left her shelter and was being soaked to the skin by the downpour. She could neither speak nor tear her eyes away. The creature's body was covered with scale-like plates of Tionium, nailed or wired through its flesh. The forearms had been removed between elbow and wrist and replaced by a metal pole that enclosed a core of shimmering glass. The hands were in the right place and wielded two axes decorated with runes. Another thunderclap sounded, and the creature disappeared back into the dark, except for its huge eyes, which had been lit up dark green. But for those, Akulana might have thought she had imagined it all.
"Palandiel be with us,"
she mouthed, slowly regaining the power of movement.
"Retreat!" she screamed, drawing her sword. "Everyone, out of the cave, now!"
At once all the torches went out. The unexpected pitch blackness, together with their leader's surprise command, resulted in total confusion. The horses were terrified by now and pulled themselves free, racing out past Akulana to her right and left. Immediately there came the sound of dull impacts and tearing metal, and the ugly noise of twisting limbs and breaking bones. A shrill cry, hardly to be recognized as issuing from a grown man, indicated the first death amongst the soldier scouts. But for Akulana, this was only the beginning. The lightning bolts came thick and fast as the thunderstorm reached its peak, allowing her a clear view of the ghastly events in the cave. It was a vision of horrific brutality. The monster was hacking men to pieces with its axes. Then it bit through the neck of one of her young lieutenants and crushed another man's skull with a blow from its foot. The resulting noise made Akulana gag. Her legs refused to let her re-enter the cave, however her brain might command it, to stand by her troops. She remained in the rain, shaking all over, and watched her people die. A shadow raced up to her, out of the blackness. With a scream, she stepped aside and dealt a wild blow. Too late, she saw her mistake. She had slain Torrent. A deep slash in his throat. He fell at her feet in the mud. He turned his unbelieving gaze to his leader as he breathed his last.
"No!"
she whispered, taking two strides backwards, away from the accursed caves which housed evil. The dying breaths of the young man would haunt her for the rest of her days. Two more soldiers stumbled out into the air. One was missing an arm and his comrade was bleeding profusely from a wound on the chest, though it looked possible he could survive it. Now, at last, Akulana shook off the paralyzing fear. She supported the less severely wounded man and left the amputee to his fate. The loss of blood would do for him, and nothing could alter that.
"We must get away from here," she shouted above the noise of the storm. "We have to report to the prince. There's nothing we can do against the monster."
"What was that thing?"
whimpered the man, his legs collapsing under him. She grabbed him under the arm and dragged him back down the hillside to where some of their horses still stood, having found shelter under a tree.
"A new, misbegotten monster of Teon's,"
she gasped. The man was heavy, and she was bearing most of his weight, and that of his armor. Something hit him on the chest. Akulana felt the force of the blow. At once he went limp. She stared at the long black shaft of an Alfar arrow sticking out of his body. When she looked up, she saw the monster at the entrance to the cave. Right next to it, there was a tall, slim figure wearing fantastical black Teonium armor in the style favored by the Alfar. The head was concealed behind an elaborate helmet. Two swords hung from its belt. It seemed almost like a monument, erected to remind people of the danger presented by the cruel race from John Balsur. The figure notched a second arrow to its curved bow and aimed straight at Akulana. Dropping the corpse in her arms, the girl vaulted swiftly to one side, but felt a burning sensation in her left shoulder. She had been hit. With a curse, she broke the arrow's shaft, leaving the tip embedded in her arm for now. Keeping in the shelter of the ruins and rubble, she slid down to the nervous horses and tried to mount one. Just as she managed to grab the mane to swing herself up onto its saddleless back, it collapsed in a heap, struck in the right eye by an arrow. Showing great presence of mind, she quickly transferred herself to the next animal, clambering on it just before it raced off in terror. The next missile missed her by the breadth of a hand, but buried itself in the horse's neck, spurring it to double its speed. Lightning struck all around. The troop leader had never experienced a worse storm. But in spite of the thunder, she could hear something else. Rhythmical pounding. She looked back over her shoulder. The monster was pursuing her with huge strides. And in all its terrifying ugliness, its lipless mouth gaping wide and issuing loud snorts, its boots left dents in the soft earth, from which water spurted up as it bounded along. "Faster, faster," she urged her horse, forcing the arrow deeper into its flesh to spur it on. The monster took aim with one of its axes and was about to hurl it at the fleeing girl when Hakulana received truly divine help. The next lightning bolt shot down from the black clouds to meet the tip of the raised axe blade. All the rune signs on the armor and weapons flashed bright green. The eyes, too, behind the helmet mask, sent out a light brighter than that of any lantern. The power of the lightning was too much, even for a creature of Teon's. It crashed down at speed, dropping its weapons, to lie motionless on the ground, steam rising from it. Hakulana did not fall into the error of stopping. She rode on through the storm to find the nearest garrison. If she did not reach the safety of its walls alive, there would be no one to carry the news to Gerdlegard of the unslayable she had seen. Chapter 9. Gerdlegard, Queendom of Wayern, Early Summer, 6241st Solar Cycle. Rodario ran for all he was worth. The cave was long and narrow, and at the far end a path led steeply upwards to an iron gateway. The water was already lapping round his ankles, so he raced to reach the opening. Realizing it was unlikely to open for him, he rushed past and tried to find somewhere further up where he might get inside the mountain without being seen. As the water mounted, so did the fear that he might not survive this unexpected adventure. Finally, well hidden between the rocks, he found an iron grating emitting foul gases. Before common sense could prevent him, he had opened the grating and forced himself inside, climbing up the chimney like shaft. Up and up, as if the flue would open at the very top of the mountain. The all-pervasive smell of rotten eggs made Rodario gag, cough, and splutter, but, using hands and feet, he continued to work his way upwards, until finally he slipped through an opening into a large chamber. Water was bubbling into a huge pool below him, filling more and more of the hollow space. If the iron door 10 paces in front of him stayed shut, he would be done for. Rodario hurried to the door and prayed that no sentry would be standing guard. Pushing on the bolt which miraculously moved in his hands, he found and turned a small wheel above it. It clicked several times in succession as he continued to turn it. Then the door opened, and he was able to escape to safety. No one was expecting him, spear at the ready. He found himself at the end of a twisting passage with rounded walls, polished like marble. Moss glimmered and spread a faint brownish light. Carefully he moved forwards, listening out for suspicious noises that might warn of a possible encounter with an elf. He remembered how silently Namora, the partner of his friend Fergus, had moved. She was part elf. Presumably, then, he wouldn't notice an elf coming until after it had cut his throat. Soon he found himself in front of a door similar to the last. This one was secured with several bolts and a wheel lock. Rodario opened it a little way, halting when he felt heat from the other side, and heard noises. Dull thuds at regular intervals. The stamp and hiss of machinery. The clunk of forge hammers. The sounds of workmen calling to each other. The air smelled of hot metal, of slack, of coal fire, and of oil. Going by his ears and nostrils alone, he would have to say he was in a forge in the Fifthling realm. To avoid immediate discovery, he crouched down on all fours, pulled the door open, and crawled inside. Underneath him was an iron platform attached to a metal ladder. Rodario's heart stood still. On the ladder were two Alphar. They wore black armor, held spears in their hands, and were looking down.
"That was worth the wait," said the blonde one. "A nice fat sailing boat with lots of crew and passengers to set to work for the master."
"Then we can stop work at last," laughed his friend, scratching his ear. The tip had come away in his hand.
"Oh, damn. The resin's gone soft again, wretched heat."
Rodario had already started to wonder why the Alphar were talking in human language. Now he understood. They were acting. These Alphar were just men, dressed up as Alphar. They gained their height from special shoes they were wearing. The disguise might have deceived a simple peasant or a fisherman, but not him.
"It's a shame we had to kill so many of the injured," said the blonde one, helping the other to mend his ear. "Looking after them just takes too much time," he laughed.
"And the prisoners enjoyed the goulash." Rodario peered over the edge of the platform. Below was a workshop 200 paces in size, with machine floors on several levels. Forges had been set up in niches in the rock face, and platforms like the one he was on had been fastened together and fixed into the stone with strengthening beams. These too served as smithies. Humans, chained hand and foot, were working to produce various metal shapes, including wheels and iron rods. Each worker had a set number of repeated movements to carry out, and finished items were thrown into the wire cages that travelled up and down at speed on a chain. At the bottom of the workstation, these were unloaded and carried out by yet more prisoners. Several machines were as big as a house, moving by means of cogwheels, pulleys and pistons, with belts and chains travelling over the cogs toward other devices that they powered. In places, some of the belts passed through the walls to other chambers. The machines emitted hissing clouds of steam. People ran around, shoveling coal or pouring water into huge containers for the boilers. The noise, close to them, must have been unbearable. Rodario had no idea what was going on, but this island had nothing to do with Alphar. That much was clear. It was what the inhabitants of Weyern were expected to believe, however, meaning that they would stay away at all costs and never talk about it. The best form of concealment. Feet came stomping up the stairway.
"Hey, you two! You're supposed to be standing guard, not playing with your ears."
Next to the men, there appeared a dark-haired dwarf in leather breeches, boots, and a leather apron. His naked torso, decorated with tattoos, shone with sweat. In his hand he swung a smith's hammer, as if it were made of tin and balsa wood. From his voice, Rodario recognized him as the man who had attacked him outside his caravan. He was sure now that the barge he'd been following had not broken up on the island, but it had disappeared inside it. The island must have sunk down again, causing Rodario's nutshell boat to capsize.
"It's the heat, Master Bandilor," protested the one who'd been told off. "It makes the resin go soft." "Then sew it on properly," growled the dwarf. "I don't want to see this sort of thing again. You fingering each other's ears, right? If one of the prisoners sees it, the masquerade is over."
He turned his head, and Rodario saw the thick beard, dyed blood red.
"Did either of you leave that bulkhead open?"
"No," said the blonde one. "I've no desire to burn up."
Bandilor's eyebrows crinkled.
"Did Mistress Veltaga come past you on her way to check the second chamber?"
He walked past them, his hammer held at the ready.
"No, Master Bandilor, nobody."
From what he had heard and seen, Rodario worked out that he had found a secret headquarters of the Thirdlings. No one would ever think of dwarfs voluntarily living on an island, let alone one that could sink down to the bottom of Wayan's lake. And their captives had no chance to escape. To Rodario's horror, Bandalore started up the steps. No matter where he looked, he could see no way to avoid being seen. He got half upright, ready to crawl back into the passage, but Bandalore spotted him.
"Unbelievable. Is that crummy actor, isn't it?"
The dwarf took a step forward and made to grab him by the leg. Rodario launched himself off the platform, holding fast to its edge so that he could do a forward roll. His lower body swung freely over the abyss, but he landed with his feet on the solid iron steps, quite near to the two false Alphar. He opened his fingers, his heart beating wildly.
"More respect, please, for my art," he called up to the dwarf, who had flung his hammer at him in fury, but missed.
The metal tool clunked down the stairs into the depths. The guards lowered their spears and attacked.
"Forgive me, I don't feel like fighting you." Rodario certainly was not going to involve himself in combat.
Without a second's hesitation, he leaped into a passing wire basket and let himself be carried down in it.
"I'm looking for a happy ending," he called, waving up. "We'll meet again, Master Bandalore, and I'll be back with an armada of Wayern's warships."
He went past the astonished prisoners, who were not daring to move a muscle. They didn't help him or join him. Their fear of the Alphar and the punishment they could expect, should they do so, held them back. He couldn't hold it against them. After all, he had no idea whether it was possible to escape. A spear missed him narrowly and got stuck in the grating.
"Thank you for the weapon, Alf," he called, only to see a second missile on its way. This missed too, the angle for the throw being a difficult one, but now archers were dispersing round the upper galleries. They would have no trouble hitting him.
Rodario jumped up out of the cage at an intersecting passage and ran through the corridor bent double. Somewhere in the middle of the mountain, he suspected he would find his friend Fergus, held in chains. Tungdil and all the rulers had underestimated the malice of the Thirdlings. Perhaps he could find out what their intentions were. They had to be doing more than simply forging strange devices. They would surely have a grand plan. He arrived in a second cavern, which was somewhat smaller than the first, but similar in its arrangement. Here it was hotter still, because of the many furnaces at work on the platforms, with molten metal streaming out of them. There was a dwarf woman standing among the workers on the cavern floor. She was issuing instructions while sparks flew about her. Close by, white-hot metal was just being released. Molten streams of alloy ran along the sand channels to the moles, where they would cool into shape. That was all Rodario could see. He reached a door and found himself in one of the twisting, polished stone corridors again, worming its way through the center of the mountain. He met another guard keeping watch at one of the side doors, a false Alf who attacked him with a ridiculous hiss.
"No grasp of character or motivation, but you want to be center stage," laughed Rodario critically.
He wasn't afraid of a human in disguise. If it had been a real Alf, his reaction would have been different, no doubt. As it was, he could rely on considerable experience in fighting, even if he were a trifle rusty. He walloped the guard's spear aside and thrust the blunt end of his own weapon into his assailant's groin, making him fall back in agony.
"The Alphar, you know, don't hiss when they attack. Get it right next time. They are as silent as the night and as deadly as..."
He searched for an appropriate simile. "As..."
"Oh, what the hell?"
He hit the man on the forehead with the blade of his spear and sent him unconscious to the floor of the passage.
"If you were standing guard in front of a door, there's probably something valuable on the other side,"
he addressed the man lying on the ground. He put one hand on the handle.
"Let's have a look."
He pushed the handle down and rammed his shoulder against the wood, whirling into the room. Clothes were strewn all over the place, The air was stuffy, smelling of stale food, and there were papers everywhere, covering any flat surface and stuck up on the walls, each bearing sketches of eccentric-looking machines and strange apparatus. Fergus was sitting on the bed, his legs crossed. His grey-green eyes stared straight through his old friend. He looked neglected, with a long beard, filthy clothes, and badly matted hair that reached down to his chest.
"Fergus! My dear Fergus!" called Rodario, hurrying over to him. "It's me, the Incredible One!"
He shook him by the shoulder, keeping an eye out for any more Alpha approaching.
"Get up, on your feet! This is the dramatic escape scene where the hero gets away and finally vanquishes evil forever. Well, that would be neat anyway."
He dragged the lethargic figure of his friend to his feet.
"Come on, we're getting out of here."
Fergus followed him like a reluctant child.
"Rodario, what are you doing here? How did you find the island?"
he murmured in a daze.
"It's a long story," Rodario answered as they stepped out into the corridor. "Prologue, then three or four acts, I reckon. It's got the makings of a terrific series.
Any idea how we get out of here?"
Fergus started to come round. "Depends whether we've dived yet."
"Yes, we have." The smell from Fergus took Rodario's breath away. 60 orbits without a bath was the minimum he must have had to produce body odor like that.
"Then there is no way out."
"Fergus, pull yourself together."
Rodario stared intently into his friend's eyes. "If I manage to get onto this damned island, we will find a way to get off it."
"But there are guards everywhere."
"No, Don had orcs everywhere. The avatars had soldiers," he retorted, playing down the dangers.
"We beat them.
It is our duty to return to Tungdil and the others to tell them about the Thirdlings.
Come along, for goodness sake."
Now Fergus looked at him properly.
"Rodario," he smiled. "The Incredible Rodario. You've earned your name again."
He pointed to the left.
"And you're right. There's a shaft that the hover gas goes out through. We could escape through there and swim up to the surface. If we survive."
"Are you sure?" Fergus grinned at him, showing corn-yellow teeth that had not received any attention from a cleaning route for a very long time.
"I built the island. I should know its weaknesses."
The door on their right flew open, and five Alpha stormed in. Two of them carried bows. Bandalore pushed his way to the front with a two-handed axe at the ready.
"There he is, the play-actor," he roared.
"Threaten me," whispered Fergus to his friend, standing in front of him. "I'm too valuable to them. They won't hurt me."
Rodario couldn't come up with a better solution, so he broke a spear from the wall in half and pushed the blade against his friend's throat.
"Get back, you rejects from a third-rate theatre," he called with disdain. "If you try and follow us, I'll kill him, and you'll have no one who can work your accursed island."
And Bandalore actually stopped in his tracks.
"Halt!" he ordered the guards. "We'll get them later."
"Get the island back up to the surface," demanded Rodario.
But the Thirdling shook his head.
"We can't do that. We'd have to collect enough hover gas again. The ballast chambers are full."
He grinned maliciously.
"You'll have to give up."
"We'll do it the way I said," Fergus mouthed to Rodario, and started to walk backwards. "Through the bulkhead door. Then we'll bolt it from inside and disappear."
It seemed like a mile to Rodario before they reached the opening. At last they got through to the next passage, closing the heavy iron door behind them and wedging the catch shut. Fergus took the lead and steered them through the narrow tubes, climbing natural and artificial ladders until he forced himself through an opening. There he waited and held out his hand to Rodario.
"Thank you for never giving up on me," he said,
emotion in his voice.
"Without you, I'd never have had the courage to escape.
I'd lost the spirit ages ago.
What are friends for? Beamed Rodario. And between ourselves, you're the best props man any theatre could have. The Curiosum can't function without you. He stepped into the shaft. After you?
Fergus moved aside. No, you first. I've forgotten to release the flood hatch safety mechanism.
He crawled out again while Rodario started the ascent. It was quite a while before Fergus followed, but it was less of an effort for him to do so. Rodario was horrified to see how water rushed up in the tube, with Fergus on top, bobbing like a cork.
There we are! That's the easy way, he said, spluttering proudly. Do you want to drown us? Rodario exclaimed. No, Fergus pointed up. I can't open the hatch until the passage is flooded. Otherwise the body of water surging in would hurl us back down again.
He smiled at the actor.
You still have no idea about technical matters, do you?
I always had you for the technical stuff, laughed the showman, high on excitement. He was about to do the impossible. He had found his friend and was going to rescue him.
What are the Thirdlings up to here?
They're making machines, death machines. Fergus's countenance grew dark.
Tell you later, Rodario. We need to save our breath.
They reached the hatch, and as soon as the rest of the cavity was full of water, Fergus opened it to make the connection between the shaft and the waters of the lake. Far above them, the sunlight glittered with promise. They struggled to the surface with vigorous arm movements, but it was a torturously slow process. Rodario was running out of air. He took a breath against his will and swallowed water, but at that moment broke through above the waves and paddled around, coughing his lungs free. Fergus was also coughing up water. When they had got their breath back, they looked around. They were drifting in the middle of Wayern's Lake, and there was no sight of land.
Some great escape that was, Rodario said, blinking at the sun.
He reckoned the island would shoot up next to them at any moment, but then, to his relief, he remembered what Bandilor had said. Even if they wanted to, they couldn't surface. Not yet.
Well, we won't die of thirst. There's plenty to drink.
The gods are with us, Fergus pointed over to the horizon. There's a boat. He lifted his arms to wave, shouting and calling to get their attention. Rodario helped out to the best of his ability, and soon the barge was heading over their way. They were heaved on board, and after Rodario told the mariners the story of Nightmare Island and how the sloop had foundered, the terrified captain steered an urgent course to Mithridania, all sails set. The two friends sat on deck, exhausted, wrapped in the blankets the sailors had supplied.
"There's a lot to tell," said Fergus, his face serious. "I pray to Vracus that the dwarf tribes can forgive me for my part in what has happened to them."
"You? What do you mean?" He lowered his head.
"Bandilor forced me to make vehicles. Vehicles to be run on the tunnel rails to bring death and destruction to the dwarf realms."
He wiped the water from his face, and Rodario wasn't sure whether there were tears there too.
"He's planning something worse than that." "The apparatus is ready," he said quietly. "It will cost the lives of hundreds of dwarfs."
Rodario slapped him on the shoulder.
"Only if we can't prevent it, my friend, and we shall prevent it." He smiled.
"This diving, by the way, has one big advantage, apart from freedom, of course. Do you know what?" His smile became a wide grin.
"You don't stink anymore."
Girdlegard, Kingdom of Eiderslane, former Orc territory of Toboribor, early summer, 6241st solar cycle.
"Do you know what torture it is to live without your voice?"
This quiet sentence, spoken in the deepest mourning and despair, floated up to the roof of the cave, shattered against the rock, and drifted back down again to the Sintoit. He was wearing close-fitting clothing in black silk, embroidered in dark green, and was kneeling in front of a simple bed on which a sleeping female Sintoy rested. A cloak, the colour of night, lay over his shoulders. He held her pale left hand in his own, gloved in black velvet. The Sintoy herself was similarly dressed.
"I see your wonderful face. I can touch your black hair, and I cannot believe what has happened to us. Not even after 5 long cycles."
His graceful features, which would have entranced any human, grew dark. None was more beautiful than he. Apart, that is, from his sister. His beloved sister, Nagsar Inaste.
"Inaste and Samusin have deserted us, dear sister. We are our own gods."
The deep, shadowed eye sockets turned disdainfully toward the rough-hewn ceiling of their meager accommodation. Nothing was properly finished, not even the walls. Those wretched orcs were good for nothing.
"This was never a place for us. Forgive me for having brought you here. It was not what I intended. But I had been too unwell."
He touched his forehead with his right hand and adjusted her hair. Even in this condition, her beauty was greater than that of any elf. Weak creatures might expire at the mere sight of her. Strong ones lose their wits.
"When you awake, we will go to the outer lands and seek ourselves a new realm. John Balsur will be small and insignificant in comparison."
He smiled at her, and even the rock face seemed to admire the creature.
"Do you remember? I promised you I would find you a new home. It is ready now."
Carefully, he lifted her up and carried her through the dark passageways of the empty orc realm. He was slim, but anything but weak. 1,000 opponents had lost their lives through that misconception.
"I will show you."
The unslayable one did not make the slightest of sounds as he walked. Only his mantle rustled quietly as it brushed the stone.
"You will like it, my sister. It is the only room in this plagued earth that I can ask you to endure in the coming orbits while you lie thus unwaking."
He walked past countless gallery openings, but knew exactly where he was heading. His path ended at the transept of a vaulted cave that he had prepared for her. The air was cool and pure, and no longer heavy with heat and the foul smell of orcs.
"We are here," he said softly.
The cavern measured 50 by 50 paces, and its highest point was 40 paces up. From there, a mighty dark stalactite hung, as if it were at the tip of a titanic sword that some giant had rammed into the mountain. Its sharp end pointed to an alfar of black basalt at the top of 4 steps. Alfar runes decorated it, and they told of the immortal beauty of Nagsar Inaste.
"I have polished the walls so that the paint holds better," he said to the sleeper,
as he studied the elaborate paintings rising all the way up to the stalactite. They showed John, as it had been before the fire, in all its glory and crowned with a tower made of ivory. The capital of their realm might have been lost, but it lived on in pictorial form on these walls. The unslayable one went up to the altar and strode over to the countless crushed skeletons of orcs covering the floor. The bones hardly moved under the soles of his feet, but gave off wooden-sounding clicks.
"Do you hear, sister? I killed them all. Their inferior blood I used to paint the walls. They have paid for what they did to you," he said to her. "I wish I had awakened earlier from my sleep to prevent the outrage they perpetrated on you."
He mounted the steps to the altar and laid her carefully on it. With loving gestures, he folded her hands in her lap, adjusted her dress, and moved to her feet.
"I will never forgive myself that they touched you and defiled your body," he whispered, making a deep bow before her and planting a kiss on the tips of her boots.
As always, not the slightest reaction showed on her countenance. There was not even a hint that she might be able to hear his words.
"It won't be long now, beloved sister," promised the Unslayable. "I have shown myself to the humans. They will send their warriors here as I have planned. That gives us, at last, the opportunity to regain the diamond with which I can bring you back to life. For I know where they are going to take the remaining stones."
He laid his hands on her ankles.
"Patience, Naxar in Aste. What are a few more orbits for such as us, who have seen a thousand cycles come and go?"
Her face remained still.
"You want to know what has happened to the dregs of deformity that crawled out of your body?"
He withdrew his hands and placed them on the hilts of his swords.
"They serve us well. But I shall kill them so that nothing remains to remind us of your shame. Only our own true son may live."
His features produced a smile.
"He is perfect, beloved sister.
The purest blood, and, thanks to the magic source, he has greater strength than any previous Sintoit before him.
Your eyes will find pleasure in him. You may be proud of what issued at last from our union. He appeared at the right time."
Again he kissed her feet, bowed, and moved next to her to stroke her hand.
"I shall leave you now, but do not worry. I shall return soon, with the diamond."
The Unslayable One went down the altar steps, backwards, then turned and left the cool cave. He had not wanted to say that he had doubts that their true son had turned against him, and that he was still very weak.
"I need that accursed stone. What took away my power shall restore it."
He clenched his fists.
"Eternal damnation to the E-Oil."
It was the E-Oil who had thwarted the magic charm that was intended to save him and his sister from destruction. He remembered. He remembered everything. He remembered how he had hung imprisoned in suspended animation, remembered the physical paralysis, the work of immense effort on the magic journey, and the effect of the E-Oil's interference. Never before had he applied such a powerful spell or undertaken such a great risk. He and his sister had been protected from destruction in the caves, but the price had been high. He had been hurled into an abyss, separated from his sister and immobilized. His mind, however, had been constantly at work, trying to work out where he was. When evil orc fumes reached his nose, he had started to realize that some of these low creatures had survived the unspeakable blast of light. Captive in the remote tunnels, he remembered the warning lines in the old writings of his kingdom, Djon, which had spoken of the E-Oil. The eternal E-Oil. Apart from immortality and mutual hatred, there was nothing to connect him to the age-old elf woman. The writings told only of the incredible power which the E-Oil was able to harness, and how to make it your own. He needed this power urgently, and thanks to those writings, he knew the formula for acquiring it. When he had first heard of the Avatars, he had sought out the verses and learned them by heart, making them as much a part of himself as was with his love of Nagsar Inaste. The verses meant sovereignty and signified victory over the elves and their allies. He could not have known what the E-Oil was intending to do in Perista. They had almost managed to avert it, but the E-Oil was too strong and had nearly annihilated him. So he lay and waited until his body belonged to him. Cycle after cycle he waited. He could do nothing. Eventually, the feeling had returned to his limbs, and he had risen up. Furious and mad with concern about Nagsar, he had searched all the passages until he found her. She was lying half-covered with a dirty cloth on a shabby table, standing away from the wall. Someone had placed a second cloth over her face to hide her terrible beauty. Her thighs had been forced wide apart, and bruises and bloody marks betrayed the shameful acts wrought upon her. 8 orcs had been sitting nearby playing cards, and did not notice him. The orc with the winning hand had stood up to the jeers and complaints of the other players.